This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Our guest is Grammy Award-winning musician Donald Fagen, co-founder with Walter Becker of the jazz rock group Steely Dan. Over the past 40-plus years, they've made 9 meticulously produced albums, and the band just finished up their 2013 Mood Swings tour. Fagen has made 4 solo albums, including his latest Sunken Condos. Let's listen to an excerpt of Weather in My Head. Fagen has written a memoir, Eminent Hipsters, about growing up in suburban New Jersey, which he hated, attending Bard College, where he met Becker, the musicians, the writers, and the DJs who have influenced him, and the wear and tear of touring in his 60s. And Donald Fagen, such a pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here.
Nice to have you here. I have to say, I really like that song. First of all, I love the idea of having weather in one's head.
Yeah, well, everyone has weather in their head. Yeah,
yeah, and as a good metaphor, I think, and also the reference to Al Gore as Mr. Gore.
Yes, well, you know, he deserves that kind of respect, you know, for figuring out that whole weather thing. You know,
exactly. It's just we got to figure out the weather in our head.
Yeah.
What made you want to write a book? A memoir?
Well, I didn't set out to write a book. Sometime during the 80s, I had the opportunity to write a film music column for Premiere magazine, which no longer exists. But and so I wrote a few of those. And then because I did that, I got some other offers to write for various other things, including Slate.com and so on. And so I just thought I'd collect them. My editor at Viking, Paul Slovak, when I sent him this tour diary I had written during the summer of 2012, he liked it and thought we should put it in there as well.
And it is in there as well.
Yeah, plus there's a couple new things.
Indeed. Well, I love the way it begins. Your introduction, you say, you may be thinking, oh no, another rock and roll geezer making a last desperate bid for mainstream integrity by putting out a book of belles lettres.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great way to start a book.
Oh, thank you.
Do you feel like an old geezer?
Sometimes, you know, generally speaking, no, I would say. At least physically, because I've been very lucky. I actually feel pretty good. But I think culturally, in a funny way, I do, because I think that, you know, I think when you get older, you feel somewhat detached from the culture that's arisen, you know.
The next generation.
Yeah, right.
And everyone on a cell phone, that kind of thing.
Yes, but it probably runs deeper than that. I think probably cell phone is just the sort of surface of it.
What's below that then?
Well, I think, you know, the way people relate to each other, and I think that technology has kind of, you know, advanced that kind of thing. Just the a kind of a distance between people. I don't think they grow up differently, you know, with the internet and cell phones and so on. Like, you know, if I get into a cab now, you know, it's like everyone pulls out their phone and I'm stuck there looking out the window, which I like looking out the window, and I can't believe they don't like looking out the window.
It's a lot of distracted people, you see.
Well, they just don't look at what's going on around them. In fact, it's funny, but you know, back in the 70s, when I think it was the 70s, when what do you call those earphones came out?
Yes. The earbuds?
No, before that, you know, the Walkman.
The
when
Walkman sure.
came out, I didn't even like that because I felt I'd see people with Walkman on, you know, in the park and stuff like that, and I said, why are they distant? Why are they like isolating themselves from their environment? You know, I never liked earphones.
I want to read something else you wrote, and this is about the touring, as you included in this book, touring.
I also find it rude.
Rude.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone's so sort of involved in their own thoughts, their
yeah,
own.
Yeah, like, you know, you're at a table with someone or something, and there's someone with earphones on or looking at their phone, and to me it's just rude.
Mm. Let me quote something that you wrote about performing, and I underlined it and highlighted it because I really like what you said here. You said, for a lot of performing artists, every night in front of an audience, no matter how exhilarating, is a bit of ritual slaying. The idea of almost like, what, killing yourself in front of a crowd?
Or crucifixion.
Is that what it feels like to you?
Not every night, but I think that and it's a two-way thing.
Sure.
You know, I think that, you know, for whatever reason, and I think this is true of most performers, or at least a large number of performers, you want to go out there and give the audience, you know, your last atom of energy, and the audience wants you to do that. I don't know the science behind that, right, or the why or the psychology behind it exactly, but I want to do that. I feel compelled to do that, and the audience wants that. So that's I think there is something to that.
Yeah. You just finished, what, 53-date tour, something like that?
Yeah, 53, uh-huh.
That's pretty grueling.
It's exhausting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you write about something called acute tour disorder. This is near the end of the book.
Well, yeah. at the end of the tour diary, I concocted it's really a bogus medical description, right, of acute tour disorder, that imitates, something you'd see on the internet when you look up a medical symptom or something. And I tried to list, all the problems with touring.
Well, I thought it was pretty funny, including the causes: confinement in vehicles, hotels, dressing rooms, and so on, with the same group of people over long periods of time, daily relocation to a new venue, nightly performances in front of a large, rowdy, often intoxicated crowd, as well as exposure to amplified percussion and electronic instruments at decibel levels, on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the kind of causes, and then the symptoms are mania, panic attacks, inability to focus, paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, that's great.
Does it get worse? Does it get harder to tour as you get older?
Actually, I found that it's pretty consistent my whole life. What happens is you feel pretty good when you start the tour, and then about 2.5-3 weeks in, the acute tour disorder kind of hits you.
And then you just have to, muscle through?
Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, it kind of, you know, there's periods where it kind of lets up a little bit. But generally speaking, it's you just got to cope with it.
Your book is in part about your childhood, also about the numbers of different people who have had influences on your life. And you describe moving to a suburb in New Jersey. I guess you're, 8 or 9 years old?
I was about 10.
About 10. Mm-hmm. And you hated it. I mean, just as a 10-year-old, you hated where you were living.
Well, yeah. I mean, I lived in suburbs earlier than that, but they were old-fashioned suburbs, you know, I liked that. But then my father got a job working for a guy who had built a brand new housing development on farmland in central New Jersey. So it was really like a prison, really.
Wow.
And it was not on, you remember that movie Poltergeist?
I do indeed.
It was not unlike that, only even more raw. It had just been built. There were mounds of dirt on the corners because they hadn't cleared them away, and the trees were like these slim little trees that they just planted and, you know, hope might take root. And it was, you could smell the sawdust still in the air and all that. And it was really, it was not a real human environment to me. And for some reason at 10, I had a strong sense of that. I don't know why, but my parents saw it as being great because, they had grown up in the Depression, living in cities as first generation immigrants. And to them, it was, great. They owned their own house and all that. But to me, this particular place in the middle of nowhere was a big drag.
Mm. You describe your mom as a fine swing singer. In fact, she sang in the Catskills as a young girl, I guess.
Yeah, she was a Shirley Temple of the Catskills.
Is that what they called her?
No, but that's what she was.
So she had what, ringlets and a swing boy?
I've never seen a picture of her as a girl, but
really?
She sang every summer from age 5 till about 15.
Wow.
And for tips with a little trio.
Right. So did she sing at home as a kid growing up?
Yeah, she quit when she was a teenager, but she used to sing around the house all day. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You describe your dad, I think it was every 2 weeks, taking you down to the barbershop to get, a buzz cut?
Yeah. He essentially, wanted me to look like Neil Armstrong.
Is that right? And this was what, the 50s?
Late 50s,
early
60s. Early
60s. So were you a kid that kind of stayed at home, or were you out exploring this kind of wasteland that you were living in?
Well, it was actually, this development was adjacent to some woods, so at least I got to, tramp around the woods a little bit. But I was kind of a stay-at-home kid, generally speaking, and especially when we got a piano around the same time, so I was really into playing.
And you're really a self-taught piano player, right? For the most
part? For the most part, I had a few lessons on and off, but I think I had ADD or something. I couldn't,
oh, is that right?
Couldn't stick with it. Well, I don't know. They didn't call it that then, so I don't know.
But you stuck with it, clearly.
I learned off jazz records for the most part, and I also used to read a lot at home.
In fact, you were a big, maybe you still are a big sci-fi reader.
Not so much anymore. I was then, though.
Right. And was it just because it was so different from the world you were living in?
I guess. I started reading sci-fi magazines that they used to have. You could buy them at the candy store or whatever. And then I joined a science fiction book club, which they had at the time, and they'd send me a book every month or whatever.
So it got you through your childhood or into adolescence?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Donald Fagen is our guest in this hour of Radio Times, the co-founder of Steely Dan. He's also written a memoir. It's called Eminent Hipsters, and we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, get back to some more music as well. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, The Economist, covering news and ideas that interconnect the world to give readers a worldview. On newsstands, in bookstores, at economist.com, or on smartphones and tablets.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are in what we hope is the next to the last day of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. I say we hope because we'll finish this campaign when we reach our final goal. We have a goal for Radio Times this morning. If you haven't made a pledge of support for whatever reason, do it now. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. So what do you get for your pledge of $10 or $20 a month? The knowledge and satisfaction that you help to pay for programs like Radio Times. We're here with you 2 hours a day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year to keep you up to speed on regional, national, and international news and trends, and we introduce you to interesting, even fascinating people and ideas. Where else do you get that kind of programming? Give us a call, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks.
The Penn State SMEAL Executive MBA program in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Professors from the Penn State University Park campus teach in the weekend program at the ACE Conference Center in Lafayette Hill. Information at smealemba.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Donald Fagan about Steely Dan, also about some of his early experiences growing up in New Jersey. And again, he's got a memoir titled Eminent Hipsters, and we're playing some of his music as well. In fact, let's go back to 1972 and an excerpt from the album Can't Buy a Thrill. This is Do It Again. The very familiar beginning of Do It Again by Steely Dan. And again, our guest, Donald Fagan, author of a memoir called Eminent Hipsters. What I really enjoyed in your book, and we're sort of toggling back and forth between your book and your music, are all the people that you write about who have influenced you over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I think like a lot of kids in the 50s and 60s, watched a lot of TV. And you write about Henry Mancini and the music for Peter Gunn and how he got you thinking about jazz, I guess, in a way that maybe you hadn't before.
Yeah, that was I remember that show, and I was very struck by the music when I was a kid, and that was, you know, kind of an introduction to modern jazz, I think. I also had a cousin who knew about jazz, so I had other sources, but it was definitely a lot of kids started listening to jazz by hearing the music on that show.
What did you like about it? I mean, I can hear it as you're talking about it. How did it speak? What in what way did?
Well, it was very very kind of very cool. You know, it evoked a kind of a atmosphere. This show was kind of a detective show.
Yes.
It was kind of a very noir sort of show, and it was the perfect music to evoke that kind of feeling, you know.
Because you lived, I guess, near New York, you used to listen to Gene Shepherd's radio show, and I think,
right.
I mean, that was certainly, he was one of the people on the radio at the, was it WOR, right?
When I listened to it, he was on WOR, yes.
Describe for our listeners who Gene Shepherd was. I mean,
Gene
what he
Shepherd,
did on the radio.
Well, most people might be familiar with him because there's that famous movie they show at Christmas called The Christmas Story, and about the kids, you know, with the Red Ryder rifle and all that. And he, Gene Shepherd, is the narrator, narrating the movie because he's as the adult sort of. And he had this great voice and this fantastic sensibility that was really ahead of its time. And although that movie is just the surface of what he could do. And he had a radio show, a nightly radio show in the 50s and 60s, I think going up through the 70s. It was like, well, I think when he first went on, it was like all night long.
Yeah, he would talk,
tell
stories.
He could talk forever. And by the time I was listening to it, it was like a 45-minute show. It came on like, I think, at 11:30, 11:15 at night or something like that. And he was fantastic. He used to tell stories about his growing up in Indiana. And he would, you know, comment on the passing scene and all mm-hmm. that. And he knew he was talking to kids, that is to say teenagers, for the most part, because he knew from the letters he was getting. And,
in fact, you wrote to him, didn't you?
Yeah, I even wrote him something that he read on the air.
Yeah.
But he was like, you know, if you didn't have a really cool cool uncle, you know, he fulfilled that purpose, really.
But you also tell, and I think it is a really cautionary tale in many ways, going to see him. I think he was speaking at Rutgers University,
mm-hmm.
and it was obviously, you know, seeing him for the first time. He wasn't this disembodied voice on the radio, and you saw his grandiosity, his narcissism, even his contempt for the audience. And I wonder if that was a lesson to you in any way.
Well, yeah. This was actually I'd kind of stopped listening to him when I went to college, but I came back on a break and I noticed he was had a live presentation at mm-hmm. Rutgers University. So I was near where I live, so I drove over there, and you know, he was great. He had the audience totally under his thumb and
yeah.
all that. But I noticed that as the thing went on, I could tell, like, when he felt he wasn't going over that well, he started speaking louder, and he started getting kind of nasty. And it was kind of my introduction to show business.
Yeah.
Like, I saw that what being on stage and starting to get paranoid can do to somebody.
Something to think about yourself? I mean, something you have thought about?
It made me think about, you know, at the time, you know, I wasn't really serious about being a musician even, mm-hmm. I don't think, at that time. And I was like, so I didn't really apply it to myself at the time, but I do now.
Well, I thought it was very instructive. As people who have these very sort of public persona, and then you mm-hmm. see them in a different setting, and you can get disappointed or see mm-hmm. things that you never heard before.
Well, you know, people who perform very often it's because they're missing something in their life. They you know, aside from whatever talent they may mm-hmm. have, it's because they need some sort of acknowledgement or love from the audience, because maybe they didn't get it when they were kids or whatever. So you see this a lot, and you know, it kind of a lot of these people like just develop these very narcissistic personalities.
Yeah. Do you think of yourself as a reluctant performer? I mean, you've been doing it for decades now.
Yes and no. You know, it's kind of that thing where I think I was lucky that I was very self-aware, so that even though I had this urge to do it, I was always very suspicious of it.
Fame, attention, what, applause?
I was suspicious fans. Of my. I was suspicious of my exhibitionism. You know, in the sense that I wanted to be on stage, but I, you know, it was like I was always thinking, you know, what the hell is that about?
Oh, interesting. Let me reintroduce you. That's Donald Fagen, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, a co-founder of Steely Dan, author of a new book, a memoir called Eminent Hipsters. I've been reading some of your book here on the air, and you talk about meeting your partner, at Bard College, and you say, as I approached, I could hear someone playing some electric blues guitar inside, just messing around. But this wasn't the trebly, surfadelic white guy sound I was used to hearing from other student guitarists. This fellow had an authentic blues touch and feel and a convincing vibrato. That, mm-hmm. of course, is the guy that you've hooked, that you
yeah,
hooked up with.
Yeah, Walker Becker, my partner, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, no, you have to understand, in those days, this was 60s, 66 or 67. Guys were, just starting to, the style had been changing, and a lot of guys were interested in blues guitar, just getting into, that kind of style like Eric Clapton played, and which is based on Chicago blues style and Memphis blues style. And, most like, the normal, white guy you'd meet in college hadn't figured that out yet. So that they were still playing like Dick Dale or The Ventures or, that kind of thing. And had a more of just straight garage band kind of thing. And so when I heard Walter, I said, wow, this guy is like, he really sounds authentic sounding. Yeah. And as it turns out, he learned from this kid in his neighborhood, Randy Wolf, who later changed his name to Randy California, and he was with a group called Spirit. And Randy, in turn, learned from, real blues people, because his dad was a blues band drummer.
Wow. And was it a kind of instant chemistry between the two of you?
Yeah, he was a really intelligent guy, very smart, and still is. And we hit it off. We read the same books and had the same sense of humor and all that, so it worked out pretty well.
It sure did. Well, let me play another. We're playing some excerpts from some Steely Dan albums, and this is Reeling in the Years from the 1972 album Can't Buy a Thrill, and Elliot Randall solo guitar. Let's listen.
That you think it's gonna last. Well, you wouldn't even know a diamond if you held it in your hand. The things you think are precious, I can't understand.
Are you reeling in the years, stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of mine? Are you reeling in the years, stowing away the time?
And again, an excerpt of Reeling in the Years from the 72 Steely Dan album Can't Buy a Thrill. And again, Elliot Randall on solo guitar. What's so interesting is, to someone who has listened to Steely Dan for so many years now, is it seems within the first couple of notes, it sounds like a Steely Dan song. Do you hear that? Does it?
I don't know. it's for other people to judge.
Right. You just do it.
Yeah.
And how have you how have you worked together, the two of you? How do you approach a song?
Someone will come up with an idea, and we'll get together and around a piano, and sometimes Walter will have a guitar, and we'll flesh out the idea, mm-hmm. Decide on a structure, and then maybe one guy will have an idea for some lyrics, and then we'll work on the lyrics together too. I think it's a real collaboration it's not like one guy will come, there's been instances where I'll come in with a complete song and he'll just touch it up or something, but that's very rare.
You start with the music first?
Sometimes one of us will have a sort of a thematic idea, and we'll have to figure. That's actually tough because you'll have to figure out how to express that in words. But it depends.
you were saying as we were listening to some of your songs that you don't like to hear your voice. And I realize oftentimes we have musicians sitting mm-hmm. across from us, and I'm watching them as mm-hmm. they listen to themselves, and they mm-hmm. don't often look very happy.
But, no, I don't.
But
especially early stuff, because you know we didn't know what we were doing. So.
Oh, but isn't there a certain... certain kind of freedom of not knowing what you're doing? I mean, trying to figure things out?
Yes, there is. It's just that, you know, it's like, I guess, you know, those early ones were, you know, we just kind of, they were done quickly, you yeah. know, we were, so, and there's something good about that. There's something good about that. But, you know, it's like, there's something about the human voice where it's like if you hear yourself playing a guitar solo or a piano solo, there's something... You have a little distance from it because it's, you know, it's really a machine,
yeah.
an instrument, you know, but a voice is a voice. That's really you, you know.
So, and that's you, we are, yeah. certainly, that we are, right. that we are listening to. But your voice is really, I mean, listening to some of your uh-huh. newer stuff, your voice is in pretty good shape for all those years
yeah,
of singing.
Yeah, it is. Well, you know, we didn't tour from 75 mm-hmm. through 92 or so. So mm-hmm. I actually, you know, my voice was kind of preserved, I think, in a certain way.
Because when you're touring, you have to sing out, right?
Well, it just didn't suffer the wear and tear that a mm-hmm. lot of people who started then, if they've toured for those 20 years, you know, that's 20 years sure. of use, you know.
Yeah. As you said, you basically taught yourself the piano and taught yourself to sing as well. Did you ever have a singing lesson?
I've had some coaching. You know, I've taken lessons for, you know, a month here and a month there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes even now you know, your voice gets damaged sometimes, especially if you're singing when you have a cold or
sure.
that kind of thing. So I'll go to a singing coach, and they'll kind of repair your voice.
And that works.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I assume rest also helps as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I once had this virus that paralyzed one of my vocal cords, and I couldn't sing at all. That was kind of scary.
But, oh my goodness!
It came back after a few months.
That is pretty scary.
Yeah.
Do you sing at
Singers
home?
Go through all kinds of yeah. terrible stuff. You're like, you become a real hypochondriac being a singer, believe me. You also become paranoid because you're constantly worried about air conditioning. You're worried about, you know, the, you know, what, how much you have to sing at a sound check. You know, you get worried about drafts in the dressing right. room. It's like, it's instant hypochondria.
And how do you deal with that? Just well, be a hypochondriac or
you just become
denial?
A hypochondriac.
And that's not much fun.
Not really, no.
I mean, talk about sort of self-consciousness, right? When yeah. you're a hypochondriac, you're just thinking about how you're feeling all the time.
I mean, you know, that's the least of it. I mean, I know some singers, especially female singers, mm-hmm. I'm sorry to say this,
it's
ladies,
okay.
but they actually sometimes develop these kind of split personalities. I'm sure there's a lot of male accompanists who would expand on this.
Oh, I'm thinking. Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Maybe we'll find out who some of those female singers are. Donald Fagen is our guest today in this hour of Radio Times. He does have a new book. It's a memoir called Eminent Hipsters. And he, of course, co-founder of Steely Dan with Walter Becker. We've been playing a lot of music. You're listening to some of it now. Stay with us. Music and conversation after this short break. We'll be right back.
Westtown School supports WHYY. Recently, Westtown modified its boarding policy, so now students who enroll before 8th grade are not required to board in high school. More about the new options, Westtown's pre-K to 12th grade programs, and 600-acre campus are available at Westtown's open house on Saturday, November 3rd at 1 p.m. Details at westtown.edu. Westtown School. Expect a life-size education. Westtown School supports WHYY.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We'll be back to Radio Times in just 1 minute. But first, this reminder about the important role you play as a listener and a supporter of WHYY and Radio Times. Here's that phone number to make a pledge of support, 1-888-345-9499. And of course, you can always pledge online at WHYY.org. Today on the show, an in-depth discussion about the Middle East, a crucial part of the world with enormous challenges and opportunities. Our guest is Beirut journalist Rami Khoury, who has a unique vantage point on some of these events. Also today, Donald Fagan, co-founder of Steely Dan, author of a new memoir called Eminent Hipsters. Where else are you going to hear such diverse back-to-back in-depth interviews? Only on Radio Times. In a time of sound bites and shouted opinions, we offer something different, and that's why you listen. So take that next step and be a supporter. 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks very much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Donald Fagan, and we're playing music from Steely Dan. This is from their 1974 album, Pretzel Logic. Again, that's an excerpt of the title track of Steely Dan's 1970 album called Pretzel Logic. You know, it's clear that Steely Dan is very exacting when it comes to the studio, and I think we can hear it. And I'm assuming that reflects some of your, what, perfectionism, taste, style?
Well, yeah, that word's been thrown around a lot in regard to our albums. I actually think it's just reflective of our... fact that Walter and I were jazz fans when we were growing up, and there's really kind of a different value system in the jazz world, especially in the big bands. You just have to play everything clean, and or else you get fired.
And feeling those kinds of sensibilities, and is it a matter of like multiple takes, all that kind of thing when you're putting an
album really.
Together?
We try to take the earliest possible take, you know, you know, we've always worked, but including the original band, they were very excellent musicians. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think although a lot of that's been exaggerated, there were a few times when we had trouble getting a solo and went through a few different guitarists and so
right.
on. But
right.
Essentially, we were just looking for a clean take that had some passion, where it was, you know, played with real... real passion, and sometimes it's hard to get the emotion and the precision together. You know, you'll have a take that has precision, but there's something mechanical about it. You know,
absolutely.
Another time you'll get a really good take where everyone is really into it, but there'll be a lot of mistakes. There'll be a section of it that just didn't come off. You know, so it's not that easy.
Yeah, you need a good engineer, though, right?
Yeah, and we had one, Roger Nichols.
Roger Nichols, uh-huh. Yes. What made him so good? I'm actually looking at his non-disclosure agreement.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
What
I remember that, yeah.
What made him so good?
Roger, actually, he started off as a nuclear scientist.
Really?
He had a background, but he quit that business because he was tired of listening to vinyl records that had a lot of clicks and pops. So he decided he wanted to go into the audio engineering.
Wow.
But he was great at getting what we wanted to hear. You know, I remember playing him a few, Walter and I played him some prestige records that were engineered by Rudy Van Gelder, a few Miles Davis records, and we kind of indoctrinated him into the sort of jazz aesthetic of the late 50s, and he got it really quickly, and he was able to do that for us.
Let me read part of his non-disclosure agreement. I, Roger Nichols, being of sound mind and body, do hereby agree to the following terms and conditions of my employment as engineer-in-chief of the new Steely Dan album. I shall neither compose nor shall I publish any contemporaneous accounts pertaining to the events taking place during the making of the said Steely Dan record, during the lifetime of the principal artist Donald Fagen and Walter Becker, or until such time all three of us are dead and gone.
Yeah.
That's great. Sounds like he was sort of on the same page with you in multiple ways.
Yes. Yeah, Roger was great. He unfortunately passed away a couple years ago.
Yeah. I do want to play a little section from the Asia album where we've got Steve Gadd on drums and Wayne Shorter on tenor saxophone, but just a couple of emails. One from Steve saying, where did you get the line, Hey 19? Do you know the answer to that?
You mean the lyrics?
Yeah.
I don't know. We just wanted to write, a song about the distance between. We were in our 30s at the time, and realized how far away we were from the culture of teenage world, and so that's what we were writing about. I'm not sure. I don't remember.
Yeah. We also got an email from Albert in Glenside. He said, I'm an alcoholic in recovery. I love listening to Steely Dan in bars when I was still drinking, but Donald's music means so much more to me now. I was lucky enough to be enjoying a tall glass of water in a bar last night where the bartender was playing nothing but Steely Dan. I feel like all was right with the world. The music is warm wisdom.
Oh, that's really nice.
That is really nice.
That makes me feel that we, there's at least some good reason why we did what we did.
Do you question what you did?
Well, you know, I think a lot of performers, they wonder, well, gee, you know, if my grades were higher, I could have been a doctor or something like that.
Oh. But not you, right? Although
no,
you were an English major, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like, I'm from a Jewish family, so of course my parents wanted me to be a doctor.
Of course.
But, I was very, I got a D in chemistry, so that wasn't going to happen.
Were you good in English, though?
I was very good in English, yeah.
And
very bad in math and chemistry.
But good in English.
Mm-hmm.
And what, the thought maybe you'd be an English teacher or a
bookstore? Yeah, when I went off to college, I figured I'd end up, in journalism or English teacher or something having to do with writing.
Yeah. Well, you sort of did, right?
Yes, as it turns out, yeah.
Well, let me play an excerpt from the Asia album. And this is, as I said, Steve Gadd on drums and Wayne Shorter on tenor saxophone. Let's listen. Again, that's a clip, I guess I should say, from Asia, from the Asia album. And, I mean, that's great. That's great playing there.
Oh, thank you. I actually wasn't playing in that particular spot, but we had a lot of great players playing, Denny Diaz and Wayne Shorter.
While we were listening to that, you and I were actually talking about Frank Zappa, and I said I've always been a big, not always, but I've certainly been a big fan of his for the last couple of decades, and it sounds like he was an influence on you as well.
Yeah, I was a fan of his from the very beginning when his first album, Freak Out, came out.
Oh, sure.
And both Walter and I independently used to see him during the summer. He spent at the Garrick Theater on Bleecker Street and with the original Mothers of Invention, and it was an unbelievable experience seeing. In fact, in the afternoons, you could go in and watch them rehearse for free.
Oh, really?
So it was like, it was a lot of fun.
Wow. Wow. And just, I hear Stevie, I hear lots of music in your music, I should say. I have musical influences.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we were influenced. We had a broad listening, palette. But, we were big Frank Zappa fans. We were big Laura Nero fans.
Oh, sure.
We loved
great song,
and then, of course, various kinds of rhythm and blues and so on.
I do want to play the title track from a solo album of yours from The Nightfly on 1982. But this does get us back to your book as well, because you have a chapter there, Nightfly, about the various DJs, I guess jazz DJs, that you listen to. And it sounded like...
Right.
You know, this is a very self-serving question, but the radio was a big influence in your life. Listen to DJs.
Well, my parents, in those days used to, like most families, used to gather around the TV. And I just, for some reason, I just got tired of it and started, isolating in my room and playing the radio. So.
Yeah. And listening to what got Mort Figa, right?
Mort Figa, yes.
Figa.
He was this sort of prime DJ, jazz DJ in New York from about, the early 60s through the 60s. And he was a fantastic jazz DJ.
And you met him in Florida, right?
We did. Years later, he contacted us and came to a show, and it was a big, thrill for us to meet him and all that.
Well, let's listen to The Nightfly. Again, an excerpt from the title track from Donald Fagen's first solo album from 1982, and that called The Nightfly. And I'm Radio... No, I'm not. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. So are you working on a new album or thinking about that? Writing songs?
Not right now. I've started writing a few songs. I put out this album, Sunken Kindos, last October.
Yeah.
We just got off tour, so I was really into just playing live, and now I'm just, floating and flacking this book,
Does it feel like you're flacking?
pretty much.
Does it? Do you like being interviewed?
I've never done anything. I've never written a book before, so it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, just to see how people respond to it, right?
Yeah, and the main thing is, you know, it's a very short kind of book tour, just a couple cities, and I don't have to sing for 2.5 hours, so it's not that hard.
Right, and when you, as I said, you just finished this pretty long tour, is there sort of a weird transition you have to go through back to, I don't know, what is normal life for you?
But... Yeah, I think all musicians and singers have that when you get off a long tour. I heard a couple of musicians talking about that, like they started to feel weird because they said they were approaching transition.
Well, Donald Fagen, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Donald Fagen, our guest, and his new book, a memoir called Eminent Hipsters, has just been published. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, this hour produced by Patty McMahon, the other producers for Radio Times, Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're going to close things out with I'm Not the Same Without You.
You've been gone. It's like somebody switched the stars back on. I can see into everybody's heart and everybody's dreams, girl. I don't need sleep anymore, but if I close my eyes, I'd sleep the sleep of the gods. I'm not the same.